Hello and welcome to Economics in 10 with Pete and Gav. Today we are going to record one of our specials, and we thought what might be useful is to look at monetary policy. One for the kind of every man or woman on the street in terms of trying to help people understand some of the basics of economics. Isn't that right, Pete?
Yeah, monetary policy, very, very topical at the minute.
So we might as well just crack on.
Let's crack on.
Okay, here's the first question. What is monetary policy?
That's quite a sort of basic, straightforward question, but let's go for it. So monetary policy, in essence, is the control of monetary variables.
Right.
And what does that mean, I hear you say?
Yeah, what does that mean?
So, the essential monetary variables are the supply of money.
Right.
You could try and control the supply of money, and that would be a monetary policy.
Lovely.
You can try and control the internal price of money.
Right. Don't really know what that means.
Well, to the layman and to less educated economics teacher... The interest rate.
Oh, I see. Yeah,
and to be honest, the interest rate is what most people associate with monetary policy.
Yeah. Okay.
And then the third monetary variable is what we might call the external price of money, a.k.a.
The exchange rate.
Oh,
thank goodness for that. I got that right. Okay.
And as I sort of hinted in my answer to the, you know, what most people associate with monetary policy these days is the interest rate, or the base rate,
right,
which is controlled by the Bank of England in the UK, or the Federal Reserve Bank in America.
Yeah. Or the ECB
in the Eurozone. In Europe. Yeah, well, in the Eurozone.
Sorry.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, let's be precise.
Yeah.
The money supply, the control of the money supply has gone through various phases. I think when I was sort of learning economics, it was very en vogue. Yeah, you had the direct control of the money supply in the Thatcher era.
Yeah.
Yeah, so about 1980 to 85.
Yeah. Are we leading into another question here?
We probably are, yeah. Going out of fashion and then coming back with QE, more of which later.
Right, okay, okay.
Yeah, so they're the basics. That's what monetary policy is. So in essence, it's the control of different monetary variables. As we'll see later on, it's quite hard to control all of them at once.
And we're going to go through those kind of variables.
We are, yeah.
Right, and that's the next... That's basically the 10 questions, isn't it?
Well, they will definitely be covered in our 10 questions today.
Lovely. So is that the first question done?
Well, I think so. But do you want to say why it's particularly topical at the minute?
Me?
Yeah. Or should I?
Well, I think that will come out through the conversation.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
All right. Now, we just heard there that monetary policy is decided by, in many respects, I suppose, undemocratic means, isn't it? It's decided by, in our country, the Bank of England.
Yeah.
And obviously the Federal Reserve in America. I mean, monetary policy, you would kind of say, is there's three big policies, aren't there, when it comes to the economy. You've got monetary policy,
yeah,
fiscal policy,
mm-hmm,
and a kind of supply side policy.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to kind of just park the other two for a moment, but obviously they're decided by government, it's elected by us.
Yeah.
Okay, so the question I'm getting to really is, should central banks be independent like they currently are?
Okay. So in some respects, we should clarify, first and foremost, what we mean by independence, because the Bank of England has a particular type of independence. It's what's called operationally independent.
Right.
So it can't really just do what it likes, or its objectives are not set. It doesn't set its own objectives. So its objectives are set by central government. So it is tasked with achieving a 2% rate of inflation. That's what it's asked to try and achieve through monetary policy, plus or minus one. So it should be trying to ensure through monetary policy that inflation only varies between 1% and 3%.
Right.
Yeah, with a sort of an aim of achieving 2%. And in the broad sort of sweep of economic history, this is a relatively new phenomenon. Bank of England independence was one of the first acts of the new Labour government in 1997.
Yeah, Gordon.
And Gordon was Chancellor.
Brown, so, we should say. Gordon Brown.
Yeah, Gordon Brown.
Gordon Brown.
Yeah, lovely. In the news today, actually, Gordon Brown. Yeah, apparently it's been leaked about Labour's sort of potential reforms to the constitution if they were elected.
Oh, there you go, exciting.
Abolition of the House of Lords. You heard it here first.
Big talk.
Yeah, big talk. But anyway, at the time, Gordon Brown was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and one of his first acts, if not the first act as Chancellor of the Exchequer, was to make the Bank of England operationally independent. And why, I hear you ask.
Why?
Yeah. So why would
Labour,
you do that?
Weren't they? They were kind of known for sort of their economic incompetence, weren't they?
Rightly or wrongly.
To be brutal about it. Mm. And for Gordon Brown, they wanted to show, first of all, that Labour could be trusted with the economy.
Yeah.
And so that was a real kind of big calling card, wasn't it? It's like, we're going to make the Bank of England independent because we want to show that we're serious about economic management. Now, explain why, Pete.
Yeah. So in essence, prior to that, you could see the interest rate as being misused, if you like, ahead of general elections.
Yeah.
So what the government of the day might do, be it Labour or Conservative, in the lead up to an election, they might cut interest rates, even if it's not necessarily what the economy needed. They would cut interest rates. Everyone would be delighted. Loans are cheaper.
Well, we're going to find out what interest rates do.
Mortgages are cheaper, etc. And so what Brown was trying to do, and as you say, trying to create this sort of new sort of image, sort of departure from the past, is look we're not the party of boom and bust. We are going to take a sober approach to economic management, to the point that we're going to almost take our hands off the monetary policy tools, let some sort of technocratic Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee determine what interest rates should be. And it would send out sort of messages to sort of the private sector, the markets and so on. Labour is serious about the economy. Yeah.
Yeah.
So does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah, it does make sense. And we should probably point out, because this is kind of quite in the news at the moment, I think, that you would call what we've got a kind of symmetrical target, don't we? Like 1-3%. So either side of 2%.
Yeah.
While the European Union has an asymmetric target, don't they? They have it 2% or less.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about what the Federal Reserve... Are they slightly different? They have a target. I'm not
they
too
do.
Sure.
I think it's less than 2%. Right. I might be wrong, but I think now, it's less than 2%.
The thing is about that is obviously they are independent, but there's a lot of discussion at the moment whether that is a right target, isn't it? 3%. Some people think that maybe it should go to a 4% target. And so eventually there has to be a decision made, don't they, in terms of the kind of objective kind of setting of an inflation rate target.
By the way, I think you are going into our next question here. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I have. Okay. thank you for pointing.
Well, if you ring the bell, I'll feel more comfortable about answering that.
Thank you.
The question.
Well, is there anything else? Oh, no, what I was going to say about central banks being independent, obviously, in our country, it's run by, you know, like you said, Monetary Policy Committee.
Yeah.
I think doesn't come up anyway. Oh, no, it doesn't. Is this idea that there's been criticisms at the moment with regards to the MPC in terms of groupthink, in terms of you've got these nine people on the body, they're all quite London-based, all city-based, and some economists are arguing, such as Danny Blanchflower, that what they need to be doing in actual fact, yes, they're independent, but they've all got a particular mindset. What's your kind of viewpoint on that, about groupthink within Monetary Policy Committee?
To be fair, I think there was a fair old rotation of people on and off the committee. I'm always surprised at the degree to which the composition of the Monetary... We should say that, by the way. The Monetary Policy Committee votes on a monthly basis. Not monthly. I think it's eight times a year, actually. I always used to say monthly. But I think it's actually eight times a year, so not quite monthly. But there are nine members on the Monetary Policy Committee, the chair of which is the governor of the Bank of England. But I think there is a fair rotation of people on and off the Monetary Policy Committee, and there are a number of sort of independent members who you could argue would bring in some yeah. sort of fresh thinking. Danny Blanchflower, to be fair, he did used to be on the Monetary yes. Policy Committee. Yeah.
No, and also what I was going to say about that in terms of the greying of the area of independence is a lot of the time the Chancellor kind of get three picks, don't they, for the externals.
Yeah.
You can go in. So you can actually kind of pick people who kind of can be part of their... I know, yeah. obviously, it's weighed up because it's only three of them.
And even the governorship of the Bank of England, it does... Yeah. I think there's definitely an element of promoting from within, but there can also be influence from central government who might have, you know, for example, I think the current chap is seen as relatively pro-Brexit. Andrew Bailey, is that fair to say?
Or I don't know if that is.
Or maybe right. neutral about Brexit, has not sort of had right. strong views, certainly against
yeah.
sort of Brexit and his impacts, which might partly explain sort of how he's risen to the top.
Well, there you go. Right. Okay, sorry.
But no, so yeah, there has been some stuff in the news recently, though, because I think Liz Truss, as part of her election campaign to become leader of the Conservative Party, was quite critical of the Monetary Policy Committee or, you know, and their sort of decision making about interest rates. And there were some concerns, I think, expressed in some quarters about, ooh, will they sort of challenge this sort of independence of the Bank of England?
Yeah.
And I think the new Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, has gone to yeah. some lengths to try and sort of reassure the markets.
But that's worth pointing yeah. out, isn't it? Because we've just said there that obviously, I know this is obviously a point in time, but the target is 1-3%. So aiming at 2%, and currently obviously we have inflation of 10%.
Yeah.
So that is why suddenly there's kind of a huge amount of criticism yeah. saying, you know, what have you been doing? It, you know, could you have been doing something a little bit earlier? A lot of people kind of felt yeah. that interest rates were kind of yeah. low for too yeah. long, and you know, it's those kind of things. So there are certainly question marks.
Yeah, I do get that. I mean, I suppose possibly as soon as you're outside of that 1-3% range, you are open to criticism. We should say at that point, by the way, every time the inflation rate is outside of the 1-3% range, the Bank of England governor has to write to the Chancellor yes. of the Exchequer what's called an open letter explaining why.
So, yeah, so there is transparency.
There is. And transparency, actually, you've hit upon something there, is very much part of monetary policy. Because the more transparent monetary policy is, one could argue, the more successful it's likely to be. And the reason for that is if people are, and I'm probably moving ahead of ourselves here, but if people believe in the Bank of England's ability to bring down inflation,
yeah.
and the Bank of England is very transparent about what actions it's going to take to bring down inflation, then the likelihood is people might sort of temper wage demands and yeah. and so on, which might help bring down inflation. So it's kind of a sort of virtuous circle,
yeah,
as it were.
But you're right, that is moving on to later territory, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I would say about like independence of the Bank of England, you could make a completely contrary argument in that, well, maybe the government of the day should be responsible yeah. for monetary policy.
It's undemocratic.
You know, it's elected. It should have all the tools at its disposal. And then if we don't like what they're doing with monetary policy, we can boot them out.
Yeah.
The one thing I would say, though, is that sort of between 97 and 2008, the Bank of England was very successful.
Yeah.
In keeping inflation within its sort of target range. And you could argue you've seen two, if not three, shocks to the economy, which, if not unprecedented, have certainly sort of, you know, chucked a big bomb into the yeah. Bank of England's plan. You've had a financial crisis of 2008. You've had the coronavirus pandemic. Yeah. In this country, you've had Brexit.
Yeah.
And then also, you've had the crisis in Ukraine, the war in Ukraine, which has created huge cost yeah. pressures in the UK, which are arguably completely outside of the Bank of England's control.
I think that highlights maybe how lucky they were in the first instance that you had the growth of China that was suppressing prices. So there are all these kind of external issues.
And you could, as you say, you could argue between 97 and 2008, unusually sort of stable period for the macroeconomy. And I think you're absolutely right. China sort of lots of imported goods, extremely cheap, suppressing sort of, you know, price inflation in shops. Yeah. And so there's probably a whole sort of bringing together a number of factors which didn't exist in that sort of stable period, 97 to 2008.
Well, the thing about this question is, you know, without being rude about the current government and however long it stays in for, it wouldn't surprise us if they did bring it in-house.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like they are just throwing things up in the air and seeing what sticks. Right. I hope that's not too controversial there.
You go for it.
Okay. Question three. How do governments set an inflation rate target?
So you mentioned this when we were discussing our last question. So in the UK, we have an inflation rate of 2%. Interestingly, it used to be 2.5% when it was first introduced. Yeah. But that was when we had a different sort of measure of inflation. We used to sort of use what's called the retail prices index, which was the main measure of inflation, which is still used for some things.
Yeah, outrageously.
Yeah, it's still used for some things.
Really makes me cross.
Yeah, go on. Tell it why. Tell the listeners why it makes you cross.
RPI is used, I mean, it's always much, much higher, and it's always used for train fares.
Yeah.
I think it's used, or it was used for student loans stuff. Yeah. And so there's all these kind of things that seem to... when it's against the consumer, it goes up by RPI. But when it's something for the government, it kind of goes up by CPI. It's a little bit cheeky. It's kind of and CPI obviously traditionally has always been lower than RPI. Yeah. And you kind of think, why are you still using that as a way of increasing prices when it's not even targeted? Because I'd get it. If it was targeted, you can understand. But anyway, it makes me cross, Pete.
Yeah. We should probably just briefly mention that as you've mentioned it. So the retail prices index and the consumer prices index, which are used now, are two slightly different measures of inflation. Mm. We move to the consumer prices index because it is the more, this is my understanding of it anyway, is the more internationally comparable sort of measure.
To align with Europe, wasn't it?
Yeah, but also I think they use a similar measure in the US. So I think all major economies use something similar to the consumer prices index. And the way that works is because some of our listeners might not be aware of how inflation is actually measured, which I know we're digressing somewhat.
Yeah, but go for it.
Should we mention it?
Yeah, because only if they're targeting it, they should know what we're targeting.
And it's the more you pick into that, it's not as sort of neutral a thing as you might think. So the process is something called, I think it's the, what's it called these days? The Family and Expenditure Survey. So a survey is done of... 6,000 households?
I don't know how many households. Yeah. Like, 200,000, isn't it? Maybe we should have looked this up. Anyway, it just doesn't matter. It's a lot of households.
I don't think it's that. So they do a survey of a sample survey of households. And from that, they determine which goods and services are most commonly bought in the UK. And they also ask people, as part of this survey, what proportion of their income they spend on these goods and services. So, for example, they might determine that people buy petrol and that forms sort of 10% of their spending each month, whereas they might also buy gym membership, but it's only like 2% or something like that.
Yeah. Right.
And that leads them to form what's called a basket of goods, which is supposed to represent the spending of the typical household. Yeah.
About 700 items in the
About 700 items. And they change each year. They're updated each year. So obviously a few years ago, DVD players were shipped out, smartphones were shipped in and things like that.
During COVID, hand gel came in.
Yeah. So it varies from year to year to reflect what people most commonly spend money on. So that basket of goods is also weighted. And what that means is when they're looking at the final determination of inflation, they want the goods and services that people spend more of their income on to have a greater weighting in that basket. So I said sort of petrol, maybe that would form sort of 10% of the final weighting of inflation whereas something else might
perform
a relatively small amount. So those prices of those goods are then measured at lots of sort of retailers, physical retailers up and down the country.
And also
online, so price surveys. And I think that is about 200,000 prices.
Okay, that's where I've gone.
Yeah, I think it is where you've gone, yeah.
Yeah.
And then finally, it's an index is constructed and the prices are compared to a base year. And in essence, the prices are sort of 10% higher than they were this time last year. Inflation is 10%. Yeah. So that's in a nutshell how inflation is measured in the UK. And it's not uncontroversial. The sort of food poverty campaigner Jack Munro recently challenged the way inflation is measured, in that they said, look, it doesn't, you know, people who are, you know, particularly at the poorer end of the income spectrum, inflation is felt quite differently for them. Recently, a few supermarkets quite significantly increased the price of their value ranges. So things like pasta, which may form quite a big part of the food budget of poor households, went up quite significantly.
Yeah.
And so in effect, the headline inflation figure underestimated how much the cost of living was rising for some households.
Well, we've always got to remember, it's an average.
It is an average. And to be honest, there's lots of things which, again, I think pensioners are excluded from it because they're not seen as typical, but even though they're 20% of the population, I think the bottom 4% and top 4% of income earners were also excluded. So in some respects, everyone has their own individual inflation rate, but the inflation rate you see in the news is an average constructed as we've just described.
Can I just say very quickly about the family expenditure survey?
Yes.
And I know I have got my figures wrong.
That's all right.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but I mean, we've been in teaching now a long time, haven't we?
Yeah.
And I've only come across one family ever that's filled in a family and an expenditure survey.
Right.
You get paid a little bit of money to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever come across anyone?
No, but very excitingly, last year, I was asked to take part in a Labour Force survey.
No way!
Yeah.
That's a different genre.
It's completely different, and it's a much bigger sample. Well, that's how unemployment's measured in the UK, and I was asked to take part in that.
Well, what I'd like to know is if any of our listeners, UK-based...
Family expenditure survey.
...have ever done it or know anyone who's done it.
Yeah.
I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist about it all.
I think it is about 6,000 households, by the way.
So you don't think it's that... So we're looking for like a needle in a haystack, is it?
No. But you could say that is a small sample. But if you look at opinion polls, which are sort of Labour Party, like 43% of people say they'll vote Labour tomorrow, 37% Conservative, whatever it might be. What do you think the sample size is for them?
2,000?
Yeah, it's about 1,000, 2,000. Oh. So this is, relatively speaking, a big sample.
Mm.
It's not as big as the Labour Force survey, which is a big sample. Oh. That's tens of thousands of people.
Yeah.
But it's still a relatively large sample for this.
I just want to know if anyone knows anyone who's done it.
Where do you stand on sort of vapour trails?
Anyway, we've digressed again.
Moon landing?
We've digressed again.
We have to say. Yeah. So anyway, the question you originally asked was, how did the government set an inflation target? So our government has gone for an inflation target which is symmetrical in nature. And what that means is, as well as not wanting inflation to be too high, they also don't want inflation to be too low. And so the reason for that is, although we sort of say, inflation is seen as bad for sort of numerous reasons. Do you want to talk about them or?
No.
No, okay. Let's just take it as read, inflation is bad.
Yeah, inflation is bad. Basically,
particularly
it just makes us poorer, doesn't it?
It makes us poorer. Well, if you're on a fixed income, if you're on a fixed income, it definitely makes you poorer. But anyway, there are other costs, but we're not going to talk about them now.
We've talked about that in our Christmas special. And our food and drink special.
But the point I was going to make is our target is symmetrical. Our government has determined sensibly, I think, back in the day, that they didn't want inflation to go too low as well, because if inflation goes too low, there is a danger of it tipping over into deflation.
Yeah.
And deflation, where average prices actually fall, also has negative consequences. So Japan, I think in the 1990s.
Classic case study.
Yeah,
this.
Had what it's called its lost decade when deflation. And you could still argue that they're still battling with deflation now. But deflation can lead to people withholding consumption.
Yeah. It's important for people to realise that, because the thing is that when you tell like kids whatever, you're like, oh, prices are coming down on average. It was like, well, that's brilliant, isn't it? And you go, well, what would you do if you knew prices were going down? And they say, oh, we'd hold on to our money until it went down a little bit more.
Yeah.
And then that's the thing. And then you say, oh, yeah. So then you keep holding on and holding on, and it grinds the economy.
And everyone does that. And the economy very rapidly tips into quite a significant recession. So that's why our target is symmetrical. It's sort of interesting to sort of turn that question on its head. Why is ours symmetrical and the Eurozone asymmetric? In other words, they're just like below 2%. And you could argue it's partly because of the sort of, historically, Germany is absolutely sort of paranoid about the effects of inflation because of their awful experiences in the interwar period. And then subsequent to, you know, post-World War II, the Bundesbank, as it was always very, very hawkish about inflation. And you could argue that Germany is the sort of most powerful economy within the European Union and the Eurozone, still has that significant influence to say, look, you know, we want it. We're not that bothered about it getting too low, because high is a really, really serious business for them. So possibly that's why, you know, it's just sort of almost a historic sort of cultural thing.
But at the moment, I mean, obviously our last podcast was about Phillips. And so this kind of Phillips curve, the trade-off between inflation and unemployment. And now, I mean, this is why it's kind of quite an interesting question about, should we now start tweaking the inflation rate target? But that's not for us, is it, to discuss, really? It's for the central bankers, isn't it? Okay. That's the end of that question. Pete, big question. You said it yourself. Yeah. Interest rates are like the core component of monetary policy.
Yeah.
Tell us how it works.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to try and keep this simple. And if you go on the Bank of England's website, by the way, there's some excellent resources explaining how, you know, in simple terms, monetary policy works from their point of view. But I'll try and explain it. They have a really good diagram called the transmission mechanism. And you might be thinking, well, transmission mechanism, that relates to cars. And that's kind of, you turn on the engine, how does that, so you turn on the, turn the key, the ignition, how does that feed through to actually make the engine tick over? And in some respects, when the Bank of England changes its base rate, or the official rate, it's also called a repo rate, that has knock-on effects throughout the sort of engine of the economy, if you like, which eventually affects inflation. So the official rate, firstly, has an impact on other interest rates throughout the economy. In essence, the way I sort of simply explain this to sort of kids is, by changing the base rate, the Bank of England is almost changing how much it costs banks, like commercial banks, your Barclays, your NatWests, to create money. Because banks create money all the time. Every time they give you a loan, they extend an overdraft, they're creating money. But they have to hold their reserves at the Bank of England. And if the Bank of England increases its base rate, it's more costly, if you like, for the commercial banks to create money. And so they're more likely, not always immediately, to increase their interest rates to reflect that extra cost to them. There are also other ways in which this official rate feeds through into the economy. It can affect confidence. You know, businesses can be affected by an increase in the interest rate. They can think, ooh, the economy may be beginning to be squeezed. We might not build that new factory now. Yeah. It may also affect share prices and house prices. If, you know, again, the share markets could think, ooh, you know, the Bank of England's squeezing the economy, and maybe it could lead to a sort of a lower sort of share market, a lower, less buoyancy in the stock market. And also maybe also with house prices as well, it might lead to some sort of depression in house prices. And if those assets begin to depreciate in value, we could have what we call in economics a negative wealth effect. If people see their assets decreasing in value, they might begin to sort of tighten their belts, as it were. And the other way in which the official rate, this base rate, can feed into the economy is it can affect the exchange rate. So if the Bank of England increases its rate, maybe more than the European Central Bank or the dollar, it might lead to a flow of money coming into the country in order to sort of buy sort of pound-denominated financial assets, if that makes sense. So in other words, in very, very simple terms, interest rate goes up, people might buy more pounds in terms of the exchange rate market. That feeds
hot money flows.
Hot money flows, that's what they're called. Hot money flows. And what that leads to is if we have a stronger exchange rate, that will also lead to lower import prices. So let's say the Bank of England increases the interest rate, just to sort of go through those three things again.
Well, we should do, because ultimately that's what's happening right now.
Yeah, yeah. So the Bank of England increases interest rate. What it's hoping will happen is that the commercial banks, your NatWest, your Barclays and so on, will increase their commercial rates on loans, credit cards, mortgages, and so on.
So that means that all the businesses now find it harder more expensive to loan money, to borrow.
But also consumers find it harder to borrow and more expensive. So you will therefore see a fall in consumption and investment.
Also encourages savings, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it encourages savings, which again, you know, an encouragement of savings, the flip side of that is less consumption. Yeah,
reducing demand.
Yeah.
Right.
House prices might fall or stabilise. Share markets might fall, stabilise.
Can I just say, just very quickly, you said about obviously share prices might fall because they might see something going on in the economy, but also it's like where you place your money, it's like a substitute, isn't it? So like, if interest rates are really low, there's no point putting your money in a bank, so you put it in shares.
Yeah.
So if the interest rate starts to go up,
absolutely,
you're looking at the economy thinking, actually, I might now put my money in savings rather than in
even
other
if it's
assets.
Just an adjustment of portfolios to sort of put some into sort of relatively sort of safe sort of bank deposits and so on. That adjustment in the portfolios across the economy will lead to sort of lower share prices.
So that reduces demand in the economy.
So you've got those few factors there, the commercial rates increasing, house prices, share prices falling possibly, maybe a squeezing of business and consumer confidence. All of those will lead to less demand in the economy.
Yeah.
And that will lead to a fall in what we call demand pull inflation. Mm. Yeah. And in essence, demand pull inflation is caused by, I suppose, too much demand chasing too few goods.
Yeah.
So if those factors reduce demand, you'll see a fall in those demand pull inflationary pressures. Similarly, the other way, if the exchange rate does rise on the back of an interest rate increase, then that could also lead to lower import prices. And import prices affect costs for many firms, just like they might buy raw materials or finished goods from other countries. If they're cheaper because of the appreciation in the exchange rate, that will mean inflation comes down. That whole process, though, is not instantaneous. It is lagged. And the Bank of England estimates that to feed through all those variables from changing the base rate to impact on inflation can take 18 to 24 months.
Yeah. And all their videos, the Bank of England, great videos, show them all in lessons. They always have this kind of the lady of Threadneedle Street, as it were, looking out to see... seeing what's coming. Is there a storm coming, or is it quiet waters?
Yeah.
And, you know, if you go to the Bank of England Museum, which I've recently done, you can play a game where you kind of reel in interest rates or reel it out, and it's all very exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, gone are the days of the boring Bank of England Museum.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the Bank of England Museum. If you're in London, it's worth a little sort of hour's visit. Yeah, it's free.
Free.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
So that's kind of how monetary policy currently works. What you said, though, that 18 to 24 months window in which it takes for the change in the base rate to feed through into inflation, it does mean that the Bank of England is very reliant on what we call forward-looking indicators.
Yeah.
They're trying to gaze into the future, and changing interest rates now for where they expect the economy to be in 18 to 24 months' time. Now, in relatively stable macroeconomic times, that might be not easy, but relatively easy. If you think about all the big shocks the economy's had in the last sort of 10 to 15 years, it's become very, very difficult to think, where's the economy going to be in the next 6 months as well? Yeah. And also probably government's been less stable in that period as well. The government policies have changed a lot. You know, fiscal policies have gone in a number of different directions. The bank can do nothing about that, but fiscal policy, as well as world events, have a significant impact on inflation, which the bank can do, the Bank of England can do relatively little about.
If someone is listening to this in 18 to 24 months' time, we should explain now that the Bank of England have kind of put up interest rates today because they're looking ahead, thinking, well, their main reason it seems that they've put it up is that they think these wage rises are going to go up, which will then feed into price pressure in like 18 to 24 months' time.
Yeah.
And I think probably potentially the government going to spend lots of money will also kind of put up with pressure.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to see whether those two factors in 24 months' time, you know, would have fed in or have been dampened down or, you know, what might happen. So, I mean, already, we've mentioned Blanche Flower already. He thinks that because they're being, some people, well, there's a really interesting argument online about it, about whether they're being too hawkish in terms of like increasing interest rates and actually will create a massive deflation issue in the future in 24 months time.
Yeah.
While other people, Andrew Sentence, they're kind of two big rivals who's recently been in the Economics Today, which we're obviously featured in, who believes that they're not being strong enough by putting up interest rates. So, you know, you've got this massive argument going on about what they should be doing.
Because the monetary policy decision, we should say, as we speak tonight, their decision was out today, and there's a three-way split.
Yeah.
Apparently, some of the people on the committee wanted to increase interest rates by 0.75%.
Yes.
Some by only 0.25%, but they ended up going for the middle way of a 0.5% increase.
Five, four the vote, wasn't it? I think the four were what, three for 0.75, one for 0.25.
Yeah.
So there you go. Are we done there, do you think?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay, cool. Now, this is a bit of a kind of a weird question, I think. But what is a natural rate of interest? You sometimes hear that. I don't really get it myself. Yeah. I'm hoping you're going to explain it.
Okay, so this is a parallel concept to something those of people who studied economics a bit maybe more familiar with, to the sort of natural rate of unemployment. This was sort of a quite a sort of fashionable term, I think, in the 80s and 90s. And this was that there is a certain sort of rate of unemployment which the economy in its current structure can't really push beyond without expecting inflation.
Right.
So it might be, that might vary, you know, depending on the structure of the economy in different eras. So possibly in the 1950s, the natural rate of unemployment was very low. In the 1980s, people say, oh yeah, the natural rate of employment's a bit higher. Yeah.
Right.
So in other words, it's the rate of employment which doesn't lead to accelerating inflation.
Right. Nairu.
Nairu, yeah. Non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. Right. So the natural rate of interest, which is also known as the neutral rate of interest, this is kind of the real interest rate, which means the interest rate taking inflation to account, that ensures that the economy is at its maximum capacity whilst keeping inflation constant.
Okay.
So it's kind of a rate of interest which keeps the economy steady at its maximum capacity.
And so this is a sort of an argument, isn't it, that I think, if I'm kind of correct about this, that you should be trying to get to that natural rate when there's nothing kind of major going on, because you just want things to go on. Because I think some people, again, talking about the UK economy, have suggested that the 0.25 level was basically kept too long and they should have tried to get it up to a much more natural rate of interest. Yeah. So that now when you have whatever it might be, we've already kind of got this head start rather than these big leaps that have going on. Yeah. Is that correct? Or
I think so, yeah. The thing is, it's kind of, as you said, in normal times, it's kind of redundant at the moment because I think the current crisis, you've got energy costs pushing up inflation very rapidly. I think it's, to be honest, much of the discussion about monetary policy is about how monetary policy is used to control demand-created inflation. When the inflation is cost-push-created, things like this they almost become like academic arguments, don't they?
Okay. Have we got a, is there an actual percentage?
You know, I think there was.
Was it like 4% or
possibly
something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah.
Anyway, we've just, what we've done there is sowed a seed.
We've sowed a seed, we've, yeah.
What did Phillips do? We've let a hare run.
We've let a hare run, yeah.
Go and chase it. Okay. That's our excuse for not researching it enough. Okay. I'll tell you what we'll do now, Pete.
Yeah.
We'll have a little break for a quiz.
Oh, that's exciting.
Okay, here we go. Yeah. So we've got 5 questions.
Well, well, well.
I'm going to ask you. Okay.
I've got a question for you later, by the way.
Okay, all right. Okay. Yeah. Now, as I told you, I've been around the Bank of England Museum.
Yeah, good.
And all right, just make sure you're not looking at the answers.
No, no, no. Okay. I would never do that. I'm a
Here's
man of
the first
integrity.
Question.
Yeah.
It's about Kenneth Graham.
Kenneth Graham, is that Wind in the Willows? No?
This is the question. Which of these is false?
Right, okay.
1, he wrote Wind in the Willows. 2, was shot at by a man named George Robinson. yeah, there you go. And then some people overpowered him.
Right, okay.
3, Kenneth Graham came second in the bank entrance exam, getting 518 out of 640.
Wow. Oh. Well, I thought he did write Wind in the Willows. That's sort of my only association with him. Yeah.
Which one of those is false?
I'm going to say he came first.
Yes.
Did he?
Yes.
Oh.
A little cheaty one.
Yes,
there.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, he did come first.
Oh,
so
great.
Apparently to work for the Bank of England, you had to pass a little entrance exam.
Huh.
But it's dramatic, isn't it? He was shot at and he was overwhelmed by his fellow workers. So there you go. You can read about Kenneth Graham. Now, question number 2.
Yeah.
What year, this is not multiple choice.
Yeah, okay.
Was the bank nationalised? Bank of England nationalised.
Nationalised. It's going to be in the 1940s. Yes. It's in the Attlee government, I think. I'm going to say 1947.
Oh, I feel like a... Ah, oh, Ken Bruce. You're 1 year out.
What was it?
1946.
Thinking.
Get your 1 year out t-shirt. That was my Ken Bruce impression.
I don't know what you're talking about. But yeah.
Ken Bruce. Pop master.
Oh, you've lost me.
Okay. Yeah. Hopefully some people out there know what I'm whittering about.
Or not.
Who was the first historical character to appear on our banknotes? It was in 1970 on the £20 note. Historical British character.
Options?
No.
Ah. Oh.
Historical British character.
Historical.
Best of British.
British character. Brunel.
Oh. Shakespeare.
Oh.
Yeah. how heavy is a gold bar? You can go to the Bank of England, you can hold a gold bar. I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you some clues here. 10 kilograms, 13 kilograms, or 16 kilograms?
16.
It's 13 kilograms.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. how do you say gold in Turkish? Is it aruru? I might have said that wrong. Altin or orog? I've said that wrong. Orog. Orog.
Well, they're all sort of derived, aren't they, from the Roman? Aurea, I would think.
Yeah.
Give me the options again.
Or Orion, Altin, or Orog.
Orog.
No, that's Italian Spanish. I might have said it wrong. You're right, though. The Orion was Latin.
Mm.
And it was Altin that was Turkish. I might have said all of that wrong.
You might have done, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who is currently on the £50 note?
I've never had £50.
I know, I thought that. I was just going to test, basically, how rich you were.
Never, I don't think I've ever seen had a £50 note.
No.
They're still red. They're red, aren't they?
Well, yeah, they are.
Yeah.
Do you want a clue?
Yeah.
Cambridge. I think the blue plaques there have been... Oh, no, I've said that. I might be wrong. No, yeah, no, I am. Okay.
Cambridge.
There's a film made about him.
Stephen Hawking.
Alan Turing. That's the end of the quiz, everyone. You got...
One.
Okay. All right.
That's depressing.
We're carrying on. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
That's all right.
Okay. What is QE, and can you target the money supply to bring down inflation? What is MV equals PT?
Okay, so that's quite a big question.
Yeah, long question.
Okay, so firstly, I'm going to take it in reverse order.
Yeah, go on then.
So MV equals PT is what's known as the Fisher equation, yeah, or the Fisher identity.
All right.
And M stands for the money supply. V stands for the velocity of circulation. And the velocity of circulation, the way I always explain it is, let's imagine you take £10 out of a cash note, cash point, or an ATM, or $10 from an ATM.
Yeah.
It won't just be spent once. You'll spend it sort of in a shop. They might spend it in a restaurant. The restaurant might spend it on some clothes, restaurant owner. So in other words, that money will go round the economy a few times. Mm. And we call the rate at which money circulates the economy the velocity of circulation. So in a sense, any economy, the, you know, nominal GDP is going to be how much money is in circulation multiplied by how many times it gets spent.
Yeah. Yeah?
The other side of that equation is simply not the price level times the number of transactions in the economy. Yeah. So normally the velocity of circulation is fairly stable. Yeah. It's a fairly stable variable. And the sort of number of transactions is relatively stable, or might grow just sort of on a sort of fairly predictable manner. And what that means is, in normal times, if you vary the money supply, let's say you increase it, because the V and the T are both constants or stable, it will only affect the price level.
Right.
So in other words, you see sort of some sort of less effective governments around the world printing money. Because the velocity of circulation hasn't changed and the number of transactions hasn't changed, it just causes inflation. So in a sense, that's the kind of theoretical underpinning for the idea that printing money does not work.
Yeah.
And back in the day, in the 1980s, when the UK government had relatively high inflation, it's probably the last time we had inflation as high as it is now, that government, the Thatcher government, particularly in the first sort of era of the Thatcher government, was very influenced by Friedman, Milton Friedman. And Friedman's most famous quote, I think, is inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon.
Yeah.
So in other words, in his view, if you've got inflation, it's because you've allowed the money supply to grow too rapidly. So you should try and target the reduction in the growth of the money supply if you want to bring down inflation. And the government tried to do that. So the government had its medium-term financial strategy.
Yeah.
Sound a law.
Jeffrey Howe.
And then
Jeffrey Howe,
yeah, I think you're right, was the Chancellor at the time. Maybe Lawson subsequently, but I think it had gone by then. Yeah. It had gone by then, yeah. So it was the real sort of high watermark of monetarism. So Thatcher, and I don't know whether, you know, in the Reagan administration followed it to the same degree, but they tried to target the money supply and bring down the money supply to bring down inflation. Now, that is actually easier than it sounds, because there are various measures of the money supply. Harder than it sounds. Yeah, sorry, I said easier, didn't you? There's various measures of the money supply, like there's M0, M3, M4. Mm. And all of these basically incorporate different things, which think, well, that's kind of money.
Yeah.
You know, and that's definitely money.
Yeah.
Because if you ask the sort of, certainly, you know, prior to the last 20 years, when many more transactions are sort of online and so on, people say, oh yeah, the money supply, it's simple, it's notes and coins. But notes and coins, particularly these days, but even back in the 80s, a relatively small part of the money supply.
Yeah.
A lot of the money supply is just created by commercial banks. And the reason why it didn't work, because it didn't work, the government set all these targets for those monetary variables, and it just missed them. It was partly because at the same time, financial markets were significantly deregulated, which means that it makes it much more difficult to control the money supply. So
they could just issue kind of credit, couldn't they?
Yeah, they could issue credit with relatively sort of little control.
And also, something important to point out, I mean, classic A-level stuff here, everyone. If you're writing an essays, if to get to that level three in evaluation, it says challenge assumptions. And the assumption we're making there is V and T are fixed. And the data at the time, I remember doing this at university, I know it's amazing to think about that, but looking at the data, I looked at the velocity of the data and it had gone up. Like velocity isn't stable.
Yeah.
And so you kind of got these kind of rules that you thought, and it's that, what's that Goodhart's law, isn't it? Once you assume something, you know, like once you target something, then it changes the target or something like that. That's the thing.
So that was the kind of the old sort of money supply control. But after the financial crisis of 2008, money supply control almost gets a dusting off, and you think, oh, actually, maybe we need to expand the money supply. And the reason for that was a fear of deflation. There was a sort of significant fear that Western economies were heading for a complete meltdown, you know, an equivalent of the Great Depression of the sort of 20s and 30s. You know, there's a real concern that that would happen. So to stave off that deflation, it suddenly became desirable to expand the money supply. And the theoretical underpinning for that was that the velocity of circulation had gone down.
Yeah.
So in a sense, you could safely expand the money supply without it causing rampant inflation.
Yeah, we should probably link it to interest rates, shouldn't we? Because ultimately, interest rates were lowered to as low as they could basically possibly be. And still it wasn't generating the spending that you would have expected because confidence was low and all those kind of things. So the normal cause of events just wasn't working, was it?
Yeah, so in a sense, you've lowered things as half as you go. That tool isn't working. We need to do something else. So at that point, it's sort of called quantitative easing.
Yeah.
I don't remember it being called that before sort of 2008, I don't remember ever seeing that before 2008. But there is a sort of a process or a sort of, again, a sort of transmission mechanism. Do you want me to explain that?
Yeah, please.
Yeah? Okay. So the central bank, so in our case, the Bank of England, creates new electronic money. So it's not like physical money like notes and coins. With that electronic money, it buys bonds from financial institutions. So these are pre-existing government bonds, so government debt that has been bought at some point by financial institutions. That extra demand for government bonds pushes their price up and the interest rate on them down. And government debt is in effect the yardstick against which other assets are priced. So what should follow from that is you'll get lower interest rates on commercial bonds and long-term loans. On all those things should encourage investment. There's another way in which it sort of benefits the government as well. Because of the lower interest rates, it should help reduce the government's debt serving requirements. So the government debt, the interest the government has to pay on its own debt, should fall. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in really, really simple terms, central banks creating new money. And in a sense, the commercial banks have now got more cash. They might lend it out to people. Yeah. That's simplifying it. The previous version was a probably more reasoned, but I suppose that's more simplistic version will do.
Yes. Yeah. And we should probably point out that at the moment, this is quite controversial because obviously, even though a lot of people would like to say, probably with justification, that the reason there's a huge inflation across America and the UK and things like that is because of Ukraine and maybe global warming, and you can listen to our cost of living special to kind of find out all these different reasons. But there is a very core group of people, you probably would call them old school monetarists, who believe that the inflation rate is caused by too much QE.
It's big numbers though.
Yeah,
about 435 billion, I think, was created in the UK.
Yeah, and the argument is that we should have kind of been reining it back in. But I read recently as well, I thought this was kind of quite interesting, that in order to pay in the UK for all this government spending that is basically not matched by any kind of tax rises or whatever, you know, to support energy prices, that they might have to roll out kind of QE again. I mean, there's a kind of a weird thing. Anyway, so it's a bit odd.
We shall see.
We shall see indeed. But QE, you know, the saviour, ran to kind of interest rates rescue.
Yeah, it's difficult, I suppose, in that there isn't a counterfactual, like what would have happened if we'd not chucked loads of QE in.
I think there was some data on that, though, because I remember teaching at the time where...
There's some estimates, like if we hadn't have done this,
it would have been
the economy would have this but smaller, but it's sort of like... I don't know. Haven't got parallel economies in which...
Very tricky.
Some did, some didn't.
Can't do RCTs.
You can't.
Okay. How does forward guidance work? This is our big man. I wanted to do a Canadian accent, but I... It would just fall into an American. Yeah. Mark Carney,
yeah. So forward guidance is where the central bank gives a steer to the markets, to business, to... sort of policymakers in government as to where they believe is going to be the future direction of monetary policy. So they would say, like, yeah, we think 6 months to a year we might have to increase interest rates, or we think we're going to maintain them at this level for a year or something like that. And the transparency of that forward guidance allows businesses to plan. And that greater certainty should increase business confidence and ultimately investment. So that's the theory behind it. Do you know there is two different types?
No, but can I just go back to, because it's Mark Carney who brought it in.
Yeah.
And it was kind of undermined, I think, quite quickly in the UK, because I think his first piece of forward guidance was, if I remember correctly, when unemployment gets to a particular rate, we will start increasing the interest rate. So as unemployment's coming down, it's like, right, we think that will put upward pressure on prices. So therefore, we'll start putting interest rates up if it goes below 5%. Yeah. And then it went below it and they didn't earn anything. Because prices weren't, there wasn't any sort of upward pressure on prices. And it went even lower. Yeah. And he was like, yeah, we're showing the... And you're like, oh, no, you just said forward guidance. And
now, he got the nickname of being an unreliable boyfriend.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I think he's on some government select committee, it's called that. Yeah.
Cheeky, innit?
Yeah.
Anyway, go on, what are these two...
Well,
two
apparently there's Odyssean versus Delphic forward guidance.
I've never heard of this. This is exciting.
So both sort of references to sort of Greek myth.
All right. Yeah. Your bag.
So Odyssean... forward guidance is where you give clear communications of your plans or intentions.
Right.
Yeah. Do you know who Odysseus was?
No.
Odysseus, he was one of the Greek kings at the Siege of Troy.
Yeah.
And he was the one who, I think, came up with the Trojan horse idea.
No way. I love how you shoehorn your Greek knowledge into the podcast, Pete.
Odyssey, must have heard of Odyssey.
Yes.
Yeah, it's 10 years it took him to get home, apparently. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Even with our current rail network, it doesn't take 10 years to go. So anyway, Odyssean forward guidance is very clear communication of plans and intentions. And Delphic is where you just give hints.
Right.
And do you know where that comes from? Delphic? Or Delphi?
No.
So in ancient times, in sort of the Greco-Roman period, there was an oracle at Delphi in Greece.
Right.
And people would go, even Roman emperors would go along and sort of ask for advice. But they'd only ever give the advice in hints. Sort of like poems. Yeah. This is my quiz time, by the way.
Like a limerick?
Yeah, almost like that. Okay. Yeah. Like a poem. Okay. And you're like, ooh, what does that mean?
So I'm now thinking that Carney was kind of more Delphic.
Yeah, I think he probably wanted to be Odyssean, but through his behaviour... Maybe it was a bit Delphic thing. When I meant that, I meant this. Speaking in riddles, But yeah, the oracle at Delphi would kind of speak in riddles. So this is my very quick question.
Oh, yeah, go on. Yeah, go for it.
So I'm gonna read you four statements.
Yeah.
One of them, three of them, sorry, are oracular statements by the oracle of Delphi.
Right.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Like they go along to the oracle, some dude in a cave, and someone would say, we're thinking of invading, so-and-so.
Got
what
it.
Do you think? And the oracle would come out with some poem that would hint at what they should do. They'd have to go and interpret them. What do
you mean? Yeah. Like one of those shakeable things. Okay.
So we've got four statements. Three of them are statements by the oracle of Delphi.
Yep.
One of them is a song lyric by Katy Perry.
Excellent.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
Okay, so. Love and money and nothing else will ruin. That's the next statement, one.
Yep.
With silver spears, you may conquer the world.
Yep.
By the banks of your dilemma, out of control, no one seems to give the answers. Make your own nature, not the advice of others, your guide in life.
Well, I originally thought that the fourth one was going to be Katy Perry, but now I'm thinking it's number one.
No. To be honest, I missed the last word off it, which is a bit mean.
Right.
It's love and money, what, nothing else will ruin Sparta. Well, no, the one that's Katy Perry is, by the banks of your dilemma, out of control, no one seems to give the answers, is a line from Katy Perry's song Naturally.
Right, that's not one of the most famous ones, is it? Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you for that right. Little quiz. Do you think we finished Four Guidance there?
I think we have.
Yeah. I mean, it's not really in vogue, is it? I suppose the idea is still about expectations. I mean, I suppose forward guidance. Would you call Andrew Bailey's forward guidance saying basically don't ask for pay rises? I don't know.
No, it's not.
Okay. Is manipulating the exchange rate the forgotten policy of monetary policy?
Well, interestingly, it used to be the policy.
Yeah.
Particularly, again, if you go back to the 80s, Nigel Lawson, did he succeed Geoffrey Howe as Chancellor? I think he did, yeah. Didn't he? Yeah. So he's sort of Thatcher's other sort of big Chancellor, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So his policy was to have an exchange rate policy in which the pound tracked the Deutschmark, the German currency at the time. So I think the theory behind that was, if our exchange rate can match the Deutschmark or Germany is a low inflation economy, it will kind of mean that we also have low inflation in the UK. Yeah? Mm. So it's kind of almost tying ourselves to a low inflation economy. We do what they do. We almost keep in step with them. We will guarantee low inflation in the UK. By the way, we should say, well, how do you manipulate your exchange rate? Because there's a reason why we don't fiddle with the exchange rate now. And the exchange rate is influenced really by two variables. You can use both of these at once. Firstly, most major countries would have foreign exchange reserves. And what that means is, imagine, you know, big vaults of sort of other countries' currencies. And you can use that to be like a big player in the market. And the Bank of England used to do this. It would go into the money markets and it would buy and sell pounds.
Forex market.
Yeah, the Forex market. Yeah. It would buy and sell pounds in order to try and influence the sort of market rate of the pound. And that's all very well. And to back that up, it would also use the interest rate. The interest rate being higher would again cause those hot inflows of hot money, which you talked about earlier. So there would be two sources of demand for the currency. Let's say the government decided, oh, the currency's too weak, we want it to be stronger. Well, the Bank of England would be instructed to engage in open market operations, which in effect means buying up the currency with its foreign exchange reserves. And secondly, you would increase the interest rate to encourage these hot flows of hot money to buy sort of pound-denominated financial assets. So why don't we do that now? Well, it's because you can't use, in effect, you can't play two balls with the same club.
All right.
You know, to sort of use a golfing analogy there.
Yeah, Jeff, like yeah. it. Very good.
Because if you're going to use the interest rate to try and control domestic inflation directly or domestic demand, you can't use it also to sort of help to control the exchange rate. The other reason why we don't use it, of course, is that there was a realisation on Black Wednesday. When was Black Wednesday? Was it 1990? 92. Yeah. 92. Yeah. 92. Yeah, good knowledge. Yeah, thank you. So this is when the government bailed out, or the UK government bailed out the exchange rate mechanism, which was a kind of precursor to the euro. And so at this point, all the currencies in this exchange rate mechanism used to tie their currency to the German mark, yeah, the Deutschmark, which was the central currency. This was after sort of Lawson's tracking the Deutschmark. It was a more formal arrangement. So the pound was allowed to vary a certain amount around a sort of central value for the Deutschmark.
It's known as the adjustable peg system, isn't it? Yeah, it was. Because you could go up or down, wasn't it?
Or a semi-fixed exchange.
Yeah, rate, yeah. But didn't you call that an adjustable peg system? I think that is, isn't it? Yeah, 6% either side of this target.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll call it that if you want. I'm not 100% convinced, but I thought the adjustable peg was the sort of the Bretton Woods pegging against the dollar system.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe I've been teaching it wrong for years.
Yeah, you may well have been, yeah. But anyway, to be honest, they're both similar. They're both sort of fixed exchange rate systems, yeah. So on Black Wednesday, what the realisation was, because basically what happened then was the markets kind of thought, you know what, the pound is overvalued.
Right.
So loads of people thought, we're going to sell pounds. We're going to get rid of them. The Bank of England stepped in to try and sort of arrest this rapid depreciation of the pound by buying up the pound on the market and also whacking up interest rates to astronomically high levels.
Yeah.
And actually, it kind of had the opposite impact because people thought, oh, they're panicking. There's absolutely no way this is the right value for the pound. So they just carried on sort of selling. But I suppose what I'm saying is on that day, the Bank of England and the government realised we are no longer a big enough player in the market to sort of control the pound. And that's, in a sense, the price you pay for having a completely tradable, a freely tradable currency. Because some countries around the world still don't have completely tradable currencies. The yuan, and the Chinese currency, is not completely...
Yeah, they definitely manipulate their...
Yeah, they do manipulate those. And it's interesting. I think we've both read recently Duncan Weldon's book, 200 Years of Muddling Through, which I think is a really, really, really good book. But in that, he says in the past, this was referred to as a kind of trilemma. You can't have open capital markets, controlled exchange rates, and controlled domestic interest rates all at the same time.
Yeah.
You just can't do it.
Yeah.
So in a sense, you have to choose which ones of those you want to control. So between the sort of post-war era to the 1970s, they would control exchange rates and domestic interest rates, but there would be limits on capital movements. Once you get into the late 70s, early 80s, it's sort of Thatcher's like, get rid of all controls on capital markets. But the implication of that is you can't also control your exchange rate and your domestic interest rate. So nowadays, some countries still have a sort of targeted exchange rate. It's kind of unfashionable these days. But for long periods, it has been the monetary policy.
Yeah.
Now, the impact on inflation, of course, is that the pound does the strength of the pound has an impact on inflation. Because we import a huge amount into the UK. If the pound is weak, the cost of those imports are more expensive. So that feeds into cost push inflation. And obviously it also has an effect on exports. If the pound is weak, in theory, it should boost exports, assuming that people sort of also like sort of British goods.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, the thing that every sixth former learns is the word spice, doesn't it?
Yeah, strong pound. Strong pound. Yeah, really good mnemonic.
Yeah.
Strong pound, imports cheap, exports dear.
Exports dear. Now, at the moment, if we think about the UK economy, with our cost of living crisis, we've got, at the moment, our pound is like bombing downwards, isn't it?
Well, particularly against the dollar. Against the dollar. And we should say that, actually, when you talk about the pound being weak or strong, the pound actually has an exchange rate, a different exchange rate with all sort of tradable currencies around the world. So the pound currently is holding parity against the euro because the euro is also in sort of dire straits, but is dropping fairly precipitously against the dollar.
Now, what's quite interesting about that, obviously weak pound, imports cheap. So imports dear, exports cheap.
Might expect a boost to exports.
So one of our big kind of markets is America. So if we're kind of importing from America, you'd expect that to put upward pressure on inflation.
Yeah.
And so you're seeing at the moment that maybe the government sort of reacting by putting up interest rates to sort of support the currency.
Yeah.
But the problem they've got at the moment is that America are also ramping them up, but at a much faster rate.
Yeah.
And this is one of the, someone put a brilliant kind of tweet about how the problem for people who want to maybe deal with their exchange rates, but just generally with the global economy, like every central bank at the moment is putting up interest rates at the same time.
Yeah.
And so really what that's doing is grinding countries to kind of a halt.
Yeah.
And making ultimately the situation worse.
It's certainly meaning that any individual country, the impact of, you know, because you would normally expect sort of all of the things being equal, if we increase interest rates, the pound to strengthen. But as you say, because everyone else is doing the same thing, those flows of hot money aren't going to come to the UK, because they will only come to the UK if the UK is rising it at a time, increasing its rates at a time when no one else is.
We should point out just very briefly, because we wrote about this in the Stortford Independent. I should have done this during the interest rate bit, but obviously the government are trying to deal with the cost of living crisis, with inflation, by putting up interest rates to try and dampen down inflation, which eventually will mean that we can afford more things. But by doing that, they're putting up the cost of people's mortgages. And I saw the other day that if the interest rate had gone up by 0.75 today, that would have led to an extra £700 a year on people's mortgages.
Well, people who are either about to get a mortgage or on a variable rate. And actually, a lot of people are on fixed mortgages. Yeah.
But for quite a few people, isn't it, that could tip them over the edge, which already is a bad. So we kind of got to understand that there's always these issues. Who'd want to be a central banker? Keep on saying it.
Yeah.
Okay. Are cryptocurrencies money? Where do they fit into the monetary picture, Pete?
Okay. Well, there's only so much I can say about this, but what I thought, because I'm certainly no expert on cryptocurrencies, it's interesting because if you go online and say anything negative about cryptocurrencies, you just get jumped on Twitter.
Yeah.
Because there's a certain sort of section of the Twitter market.
Yeah, but let's be positive.
Anyway, do you own any cryptocurrencies?
No.
No, okay, me neither. Yeah, I do know, one of my friends does, and he's sort of, seems like everyone I do know who owns any cryptocurrencies, they're very evangelical about it.
I think I said to you, I was absolutely amazed. I met up with some old students and I couldn't believe how many of my economics students had put loads of their savings into cryptocurrency and had lost loads of it recently because of the dive in crypto. And it's interesting because I suppose it comes back to this idea where they fit into the monetary picture. They're kind of outside the normal kind of modelling. Yeah. And young people had kind of lost faith in institutions.
Yeah.
And so they stuck money in this thing, but then obviously it bombed. I think what we should probably talk about here, I don't know what you're going to talk about. Well, it's the four functions of money.
Well, or the six functions.
Oh, you're going to talk about six? Okay, well, because normally you talk about four functions of money, don't you? From a specification point of view. Well, you say you're six.
Okay, well, I'm sure it'll cover yours. So the functions of money, because in a sense, your question originally was, is cryptocurrency money?
Yeah.
So for something to be considered money, it has to sort of perform the following functions, or that's the sort of
this came
the textbook.
From Smith, wasn't it? I think we talk about this in our Smith podcast.
Possibly.
Anyway, maybe.
So anyway, function one, it has to be a medium of exchange.
Right.
And what that means is this sort of gets around the problem of, you know, barter.
Yeah.
Around the problem of a coincidence of wants. I was explaining this to one of my classes the other day. Let's say I'm a sheep farmer, but I want to buy a new table. If I go to the market and there isn't sort of money as a medium of exchange, I have to find someone selling tables who want sheep.
Yeah.
If I don't have that.
Complete coincidence. What? Yeah. You want the same?
I want that. Which is obviously quite implausible.
Yeah.
But if we have money, I can find just anyone who wants to buy sheep. They give me money. And then I go and find a table maker and a carpenter or whatever. And I give them the money.
Yeah. So crypto?
Probably not at the moment used as a medium of exchange.
Delayed, isn't it? It's a little bit of a while.
Yeah. Or it's not used commonly anyway, whether it could become that in the past.
What's the country that's got Bitcoin as its...
It's not Ecuador, is it?
Something like that, isn't it? So obviously for them, it must be working as a medium of exchange, I guess.
Yeah, well, maybe it does for certain transactions. Yeah. I don't know.
Okay, next one.
A measure of value. So it's a way of sort of a yardstick for comparing the value of different things.
Yeah.
Yeah. The third one is a store of value.
That's the difficulty.
Yeah. So in a sense, does it keep its value? If you don't want to spend things immediately, does money sort of keep its value? So if you think, I want to just keep this to one side because I want to buy something in the future, does it sort of allow you to store that value, if you like? The fourth function, I think this is probably the one of the ones you weren't going to say, the basis of credit.
Right.
You know, you can use money to sort of create credit.
Right.
The fifth one is a unit of account.
Yeah.
You know, sort of measuring sort of...
That's worth 2 bitcoins.
Yeah, exactly. And the sixth one is a standard of postponed payment.
Yes, means of deferred, but
Yeah, means of deferred payment. Yes. So you can say, I will say in 6 months' time, I will give you this much of it. So there's no, I mean, in some respects, cryptocurrencies could perform most of those. At the moment, they don't.
Shown to be very volatile, isn't it? That's the problem.
Yeah, like the volatility would call into question the store of value. And it would also make some of the others sort of challenging, I think. It's not commonly used as a medium of exchange.
Yeah.
Like, how would you do that? Is there the means to do that as readily?
Yeah.
But possibly there could be in the future. I think I'm just risk averse, ultimately.
Yes.
There was a really interesting article I read, though, about cryptocurrencies in the US. And it basically was talking about how black investors were particularly attracted to cryptocurrencies, and perhaps because of some suspicions about the sort of traditional markets.
Yeah.
But it's actually a lot of people in the black community have had their fingers burnt, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, and that was one of what one of my students said as well.
Which is not, obviously not a great outcome.
No.
You can see why there might be suspicions or maybe lack of access to sort of traditional financial sort of institutions, but maybe cryptocurrencies aren't the answer to that problem.
Well, one of the issues as well is that you probably shouldn't, you know, a currency shouldn't be dependent on whether a celebrity says, oh, I'm going to buy some Bitcoin, Elon Musk, or I think the Kardashians kind of did it. And so it's like, oh my word, they're going to do it, then I'll do it. And, and so you kind of got some very oddities going on. Well, how does it fit into the monetary kind of policy picture? I mean, the thing is, it's interesting, is that Hayek felt that kind of central banks shouldn't have a monopoly on currency, didn't he?
And, yeah.
But obviously then it's very difficult to control. But then I suppose that's the point. He wanted competition, didn't he?
Yeah, like... Yeah, and actually, if you look at the early sort of days of the dollar, it wasn't quite central. There was sort of the Texan dollar. You know, there were different dollars, if you like, and eventually it was sort of, I think, nationalised.
Yeah, and I suppose alternative currencies over here, I mean, it's quite interesting. I saw when I was in the Bank of England Museum, the Lewis pound was in there, and the Brixton pound, I think that was in there as well.
Yeah, you get these kind of... local currencies as a way of, in this country, I don't think where else do that, as a way of trying to keep spending within a local community and promote local businesses.
I think
they had
it in Bristol. Bristol was another one.
Yeah.
But this is the thing, eventually it all comes back to the central thing, but Bitcoin's slightly outside of that. So we haven't really answered the question there.
No, we haven't, but I think
it's a discussion about that. Ultimately, there's another world out there, isn't there?
Yeah, we've reached the limit of our knowledge.
Okay. and the Bank of England can't really do much about it.
Well, they certainly can't.
Well, I suppose it's an alternative asset, isn't it? You know, when you talked about the transmission mechanism.
Yeah.
And so there's a kind of an influence that the bank has there. If they're putting interest rates up.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, I suppose. You know. Yeah, if it makes other assets sort of more valuable, and that could detract the
and that's probably why if you think Bitcoin, interest rates have been 0.25% for ages, and you're a young kid who wants to try and make a buck fast, you're not going to be doing it in savings. But you look at Bitcoin, you think, oi oi, here we go.
Well, some people have made a lot of money, there's no question about that.
Exactly. Right, final question, we've hit number 10. What good books are there to read on monetary policy?
Okay, so I've not read this book, but I think you have, and I just assume that it covers some monetary policy, which is the book written by the Bank of England economist, Rupal Patel.
Brilliant book.
And Jack Meaning.
We've written authoritatively for the Economics Today magazine on this book, Pete.
You wrote that bit.
Yeah. Okay.
I'd like to read it.
It is a superb. Yeah. I would say, I think what's quite interesting, I think we did in the review of the summer reading special, first three books, a bit micro-y, chapters, next two or three a bit macro-y, and then the kind of last four are very much what the Bank of England do, monetary policy. It's superb. Always go on about it. Brilliant.
So that would be a good book to read.
Yeah.
I think a book I've mentioned in passing in the book, which actually just covers the sort of history of economic policy making, if you like, over the last 200 years, and covers, I think, really effectively and simply the government's approaches to monetary policy throughout different eras, is Duncan Weldon's 200 Years of Muddling
Brilliant
Through.
Brilliant book.
The more ambitious amongst our listeners might want to read Stephanie Kelton's The Deficit Myth.
Yeah.
It's a completely sort of radical take on sort of modern monetary theory.
Modern monetary theory.
Which at some point we should read, understand and take on in a podcast.
I've read it.
Yeah. Did you understand it?
Yeah, I kind of thought it was more sort of fiscally related than monetary, if that makes sense. But, you know, obviously it's connected.
Yeah.
But there you go. Yeah, three excellent books
there. And one more for the gifted and talented amongst our listeners. You could read, if you want to get the sort of monetarist take on things, or just a really good piece of economic history, a monetary history of the United States, 1867 to 1960, by Friedman and Schwartz.
Yeah, very good.
By all accounts, that's the book Friedman was most proud of.
Oh, right.
Okay. One of the books he was most proud of.
I think you should probably add in there, I don't know who authored it, but I know it was always a fantastic book to read, was The Chancellor's Tales.
Right.
So we've been talking about, you know, going back in history and listening to what the Chancellor, so Lamont related to the exchange rate mechanism, and Lawson, and then going back to Howe. So it's kind of The Chancellor's Tales is interviews of those dudes, and obviously they're going to be speaking about the link between fiscal policy and monetary policy and stuff like that. So The Chancellor's Tale is really...
And I don't think actually we perhaps talked about that enough in the podcast, but it's probably a separate podcast. It's just the interplay between fiscal and monetary policy. And we're seeing that at the moment because I think tomorrow the new Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK, Kwasi Kwarteng, is going to announce... It's not a budget, it's a fiscal event.
Yeah. Well, we're apolitical here, aren't we?
There's a fiscal event which could well unleash sort of greater demand in the economy.
What people would call loose.
Yeah, a loosening of fiscal policy, which arguably could be negated or almost certainly will be responded to by a tightening of monetary policy.
Which is kind of the opposite of when George Osborne was doing, you would argue, austerity. So tightening fiscal policy.
And loose monetary policy.
Loose monetary policy.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
Everything comes around in the end, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. Right. Now, Pete, that's the end of the 10 questions. But never fear. My poetry's here.
Oh, you've got a poem.
Okay. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
No, you've got nothing to read out.
Oh, good. Thank God for that. Here we go. Yeah.
This is called A Monetary Policy Poem.
Right.
You wish to learn about monetary policy? I see. Well, let me help you. I have a degree. It's all decided at the B of E with a group called the MPC. They have to keep inflation between 1 and 3. And to do that, they have to foresee what's going to happen in the economy. It's difficult, of course, you have to agree. Like predicting a war by the Black Sea or a pandemic. But that's reality. Their main instrument is interest rates to a certain degree, which influences savings and loan rate fees. But if that doesn't work, then try QE, which gives commercial banks cheap money. Or they can try forward guidance, where they decree what their decisions are likely to be, hoping this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Exchange rates can be influenced, but it's unlikely, as the Forex market is now set free. So, that's it really. That's the policy. Now you can be the next Bailey.
There's a lot of rhyming of E there.
Yeah, I thought I'd do the whole poem.
An unprecedented amount of it.
I know. And I couldn't believe it when I was thinking about that end, and I thought, hold up, Bailey? Andrew Bailey, it fits.
It's a gift.
And, it is a gift. Anyway, we hope that you've enjoyed our Munchy Spotty special and that it has given you some sort of inkling into the workings of it. And obviously, there's loads of debates going on with Munchy policy at the moment. And we're obviously about economics for everyone. We want everyone to be joining in the debate. So hopefully this has helped. We'd like to thank Nick, as always, for his kind of technical assistance and polishing, putting lipstick on a pig. And that's about it, really. Have you got anything to say?
No, if you want to email us, we'd love to hear from you. It's economicsin10@gmail.com. If you want to follow us on Twitter, we'd be delighted to interact with you on Twitter.
Yeah, on Instagram.
On Instagram,
with economicsin10.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So do contact us. We love feedback, good or bad. Tell us we're awful. If you do it in a polite manner, we'll listen. Or tell us we're great and it'll make our day. But debate with us. Tell us what you think.